CliffCentral.com.
There's lots to talk about with our guest who's coming in a moment, Mark Haywood. Section 27, they call themselves Catalysts for Social Justice, and they're doing excellent work, and they were very much at the forefront of the marches that were held all over the country on Friday. And Mark's smiling, which means that he must be quite pleased with how the marches turned out. Of course, the president says it was just racists. How dare you have even taken to the streets to complain about anything when all he knew from the start and all that really matters is that you're just a bunch of racists. What the hell were you thinking, Mark Haywood, huh? Nice to see you.
Morning, Gareth, and thanks for having me.
Sure, I've seen you so much on the news lately. You've been very busy.
Yeah, it's a difficult time. It's an interesting time, challenging, inspiring, yeah. 20 hours a day. Seeing the best of South Africa, seeing the worst of South Africa, seeing things that threaten and things that create opportunities. So, yeah, it's a roller coaster.
Now, Mark, it takes a special sort of person to be involved in an NGO. It takes an interest in social justice. It takes an interest in things that don't necessarily end up feeding your family, putting bread on the table or putting money in your back pocket. And a lot of the time it's thankless work, and a lot of the time you get called all kinds of things by government, by business, by ordinary citizens. And you really have to put your head down and just focus on the goal. In the case of Section 27, it is social justice. It's things like education, it's democracy, it's stuff that's sometimes a little bit nebulous. What the hell keeps you going?
That's such a big question.
You got to start with the big questions, right?
You know, I think
work our way back to the small ones.
This may sound cliched, but actually, what keeps me going is constant encounters with people and seeing in people their creativity, the ingenuity, the goodness, the opportunity, the possibility in people. You know, what kind of pushed me into this work was my early life as a student was in literature, love of literature. I studied English literature at Oxford University, and everything I read told me about the beauty of art and writing and possibility, but it also told me about justice and about injustice. And I kind of instinctively at quite an early age decided that if I was going to enjoy the best of what the world has to offer, and I think it has wonderful wonders, if you like, to offer, then I had to do it as part of a quest for equality and justice. And back in those days, you know, I was a kid in the dying days of apartheid. I'd grown up in different African countries, in Nigeria, Ghana, Botswana. So, you know, initially my gravitation was towards the struggle for equality and the struggle against racism in this country. But over time, it evolved because we won freedom in 1994. At that point, I thought, okay, job done.
Right. You can retire now.
I'm going to retire. I applied for a job in the African Literature Department at Wits University because I'd done an MA as a kind of cover for political activities. Yeah. And then AIDS came along, and I was a personal friend of Zaki Ahmed. Mm-hmm. We'd both worked and lived together underground. And he got HIV, and his life changed. And so he drew me into HIV, work on HIV, and I had no idea about what HIV involved. But suddenly I saw that everything that we'd fought for up to 1994 could be threatened by something that at that stage was pretty much hidden,
yeah,
but was going to kill a lot of people and attack a lot of people's dignities. So that's a long answer. But
that's a good place for us to pause for a second, because, you know, a lot of us right now are saying, God, we would do anything for Thabo Mbeki. But we forget that that this was a major, major blunder. It was just such a blind spot for him.
Yeah.
The idea that HIV didn't cause AIDS, yeah, that supplying antiretrovirals was unnecessary, that people, he had that stupid, stupid, stupid Minister of Health, who, thank goodness, we're rid of, Manta Shabalala Msimang, who said, oh, well, you just cook up a bit of beetroot and some cabbage and some sweet potato, and with a good diet, you can cure AIDS. It's almost as bad as our president now saying that you could just have a shower and you'll get rid of AIDS. The single biggest threat to the healthy life of a South African male or female, adult or child, is this scourge. And you have people in powerful positions who are just not taking it seriously.
Yep. Look,
it's enough to make anyone an activist.
Look, I mean, to go back to where you started there, I would love to love Thabo Mbeki. Mm. You know, there's so much about that man that is inspiring, mm-hmm. that attracts you, his intellect.
Sure.
But I can never forgive Thabo Mbeki. Never. I will never be part of people who look back and say, let's resuscitate this man because he was this quiet, far-sighted intellectual. AIDS was not just a little blind spot. His approach to AIDS directly brought about the deaths of at least 365,000 people. That is a calculation that has been made by scientists. It's published in a peer-reviewed academic journal, one of the best journals in the world, 365,000 deaths. But, you know, not only that, we are still mopping up for 10 years of AIDS denialism. You know, we still have in this country 150,000 AIDS deaths a year. People seem to think that AIDS has gone away. We still have close on 1,000 infections a day, new infections. Mostly, by the way, young girls, 283 infections a day. I don't know how they get to precisely that figure. But let's call it 250 young girls in this country between the ages of 14 and 24 are infected with HIV every day. And that's what happens when you bugger up and mess about with something as serious as a communicable disease.
Do you think in his quiet, solitary moments, of which there must be many at the moment, that Thabo Mbeki is genuinely upset? Because in his book, he certainly, well, the book that was written about him, he certainly doesn't seem to make an open apology for this very obvious blunder. History is not going to be on his side.
No.
The less kind and generous writers will say that it was a kind of genocide.
Mm. There's no evidence, and that's the perplexing thing. Is, you know, I can't understand. I look at this man who, on many levels, is clever and sensitive, but on another level, shows absolutely no sense of responsibility or no desire to apologize or to admit to a very serious error. I suppose if your error is as grave as his over HIV, it's a very hard, big step to take to say, well, I did something that destroyed so many lives. But I don't know how he lives with it.
Do you think he'd open himself up to legal claims if he did?
I don't know if that's a consideration. You know, certainly nobody in my circle talks about legal claims, any sort of pursuit of that approach. I think what most people would like would just be an admission. You know, it would help a lot of people to close the door, to close the chapter. I still, you know, there was a point in the 2003, 2004 when I felt like I was living in a war, the rate at which friends were dying. You know, these were people that we were very close to. One day in 2003, I went to two funerals on the same day, a friend called Charlene Wilson in the morning and another chap called Edward Mabunda in the evening. So I still know those families, and people are still suffering. People who unnecessarily lost people that they loved in those days. So And nobody understands it, you know.
Yeah.
The great man has not really let us into his mind other than in kind of cryptic letters every now and again where he admits but doesn't admit at the same time. It doesn't help.
And I spoke to someone from Zimbabwe just the other day who said that they feel very much the same about his foreign policy towards that country. And the plight of so many refugees in South Africa now is directly attributable his bad decisions about quiet diplomacy.
Yeah.
But let's leave Thabo Mbeki alone, because we really do have bigger fish to fry. And what's done is done, for better or for worse. And clearly in this case, for many people, it's much worse. Section 27 was part of a strategic alliance of NGOs, opposition parties, foundations, religious leadership organizations, a really hodgepodge mix of civil society and politics that marched on Friday. A lot of people are saying very successfully. A lot of people are saying just unsuccessfully, and some are saying, well, it was just racist. How was it on Friday? You were there. You were part of the planning around these marches, certainly the Pretoria one. Mm. How did you feel it was received? How do you think it went down? And what do you think the public perception of it is?
I think that the march was very, very successful. But I wouldn't encourage any complacency about it.
You know, so it's by no means an achievement.
It's by no means an achievement. It's by no means the end. If conservatively we had 30,000 people on the streets of Pretoria, I hope there'll be 100,000 people on the streets of Pretoria for the political party's led march tomorrow. Mm-hmm. If people felt they went out of their way last Friday to be seen to be active citizens and concerned about the future of our country, and if they think that they've done their job now, then they should think again. Because we're in a very rocky, dangerous point in the life of our country, and it's going to take more than stepping out on one march to protect the future of our country. Having said that, I was inspired by it. You know, this nonsense about racism is just utter nonsense. I mean, what was palpable, and I stood and watched that march, stood on the side, watching that march from the first marcher to the last marcher as it went into the union buildings, because I wanted to get a feeling of it. I didn't go rushing off to the stage, of the scale and of the people. You know, it's always important. And what came across to me was unity of purpose, was a strong sense of non-racialism, was a strong sense of solidarity between people of different races. You know, white people have different political viewpoints, some more to the right, some more to the left. But what I saw of white people on that march was people in the middle. I didn't spot a single person who I thought, what is that racist doing there? I didn't see a single poster that I considered racist. And if I did, I would have stopped it because that's not what we're about. And we're about rebuilding the best traditions of non-racialism, the traditions that eventually set this country free, the traditions that Mandela, that Harney, that Kathrada, all of those people stood for, and that they didn't stand for easily. You know, to establish a tradition of non-racialism was not easy. In the struggle. In the 60s and the 70s, there were powerful currents against non-racialism. That's what we are trying to do. So I was very proud is the wrong word, but a sense
encouraged.
Of encouraged by what I saw.
Did you feel that the marches were representative of a broad range of South African ethnic, cultural creed backgrounds, tribal backgrounds, ideological backgrounds, or do you feel it was kind of an expected majority from a certain?
No, it was representative, and I say this not in a defensive fashion. That march struck a chord, particularly with ordinary people and poor black people. March was probably, I would say, 70% black people. Mm-hmm. And I would say that of that, a large portion came out of poor and struggling communities. And I know that.
Well, they're the ones who are affected the most.
And they are who are affected the most. And those are the people who have most to risk with what is going on. I know because, Gareth, if I can just say, I was in Church Square all week. People came from as far away as Vereeniging. Yeah. Kahiso. I just got a message on my phone this morning from a lady in Kwakwa saying, stand firm. Don't feel intimidated by any of these threats, the playing of the race card. I know, I trust, I believe in the decency and the integrity and the commonality between most people in South Africa. People are trying to split us again, and it won't work.
Isn't there something deeply patronizing, quite bigoted about what Nomvula Mokonyane said the other day? First of all, that we need to destroy our economy completely and rebuild it again on our own terms, because she expects that South Africans are dumb enough to eat that up.
It's just, I mean,
is there something similarly bigoted and patronizing about what Black First Land First did outside the Gupta compound? And isn't there something deeply upsetting about what the president says when he talks about this? There's a real problem in the world in some places with some people when it comes to racism. It's a big problem that we need to deal with in the world. It's not something to be glibly referred to as a blanket excuse for why your enemies have gathered together to show that they're your enemies. Isn't it also disrespectful of those poor people who the president has plunged into even greater, deeper poverty?
Look, I couldn't agree more. It's deeply disrespectful. It's deeply dishonest. It's deeply deceitful to do what these people are doing. And it's deeply, deeply divisive. You know, the worst racism is somewhere deeply embedded in a government that has had a lot of power over the last 10 years and huge resources to address the crisis in the basic education system, to address the crisis in the public healthcare system, and has done next to nothing, has allowed basic education to deteriorate to a standard that is lower than what was on offer under apartheid. Mm. To be quite honest with you, the day when a little boy drowns in a toilet in Limpopo, in a province where 2 billion rand a year is stolen out of the public education budget, without a murmur from the president, without a single person going to prison, without any efforts to track down where that 2 billion rand is, without anybody asking why is it that 80,000 kids in Limpopo still go to the toilet in the bush or in these disgusting pit toilets. That's the disrespect to black people in this country, of this government. And for me, that people like Zuma and Mokonyane and so on can tolerate this, can tolerate their own complicity in the pain and suffering of so many hundreds of thousands of citizens, says something very dark about them.
Have we lost the ability to sit down and talk about these things rationally, though? Because what worries me is that the ANC Youth League shot down Pravin Gordhan at the Durban Memorial for Ahmed Kathrada. The MK vets march and carry on outside Luthuli House as if there's an existential threat to the ANC or Luthuli House. It's almost comical, because their defensiveness portrays a sort of vulnerability and insecurity rather than actual threat.
Yeah.
And we don't have a middle ground where we can meet and discuss the facts, where we can debate the real problems. It seems that everything is political. It seems that everything is ideological. There isn't any sense of what really is and what really isn't in terms of our problems in South Africa.
Gareth, I think that's a very good question, and I agree with you and I disagree with you. I disagree with you to the extent that there are people on the extremes of any society who will divide and use ideology and try and close down discussion, often to protect their own interests. Mm. And that is what we're seeing happening through members of the ANC Youth League, through certain cabinet members, etc. They are raising straw men, as it were, to cause distraction and to cause division and to cause confusion. The reason they do that actually isn't ideological. It's because they are protecting ill-gotten gains that have now come about through criminality.
So it's criminally pragmatic.
It's criminally pragmatic.
Okay.
But take hope from this, and believe me when I say it, because I'm in the middle of it. There is a growing middle ground. There's a spreading middle ground. There's a level of discussion between business and civil society and churches and trade unions that was not there a couple of years ago. I've been in this, as you know, for 25 years. That is what is giving me hope. And my hope is that if we can overcome this current threat, we are going to start rebuilding South African society on the grounds envisaged in the Constitution and envisaged from 1994 onwards. And that's what I keep saying to some of the people I work with, particularly from business people. It was your selfishness that put us into this nasty place in certain ways, because the inequalities, etc., you are also complicit in.
Mm.
So can we now work the common space? Because the thing I see about South Africa, and we discussed it earlier on, every day is the imagination, the skill, the intelligence. The people know what's going on.
Yeah.
If you gave people carte blanche to rebuild society, to reimagine society, we would, and we could still be one of the best countries in the world, if not the best country in the world.
But you're a bit of an idealist.
I am.
And that's okay. I'm not. That's not a criticism. Where I think you and I would probably disagree is when it comes to things like free market capitalism. You said already just in this last sentence that, you know, business has been greedy and has let South Africa down. Now, I'm by no means going to excuse the fact that business has certainly for the last 10 to 20 years been complicit in and lacking in courage when it comes to social cohesion, social justice issues, standing up to government, standing up for what's right, looking after the people who work for them. Sure, all of those things are valid complaints. But I think ideologically, again, if we have to go there, and I suppose we do, would you put yourself in the camp of being as left as a socialist, as left as a Marxist, as left as a practical communist for all intents and purposes?
Gareth, can I...
You might have been when you were younger.
Yeah, I was going to say, you allow me to step back a little bit. Look, I'm about to have a book that's coming out in a couple of weeks which will explain some of this. But as a youngster, I was a Marxist. I read extensively in Marxism. I was a Trotskyist. I was a dialectical materialist.
Gotcha.
Whatever, you're all of those things.
Sure.
I am still a... I would describe myself as a radical social democrat. I would certainly put myself more on the side of socialism than of capitalism. I do not like the excesses of capitalism. But I do also no longer think that some of the pat things that we talked about as youngsters, nationalize the commanding heights of the economy, et cetera, they're not feasible in this modern globalized economy.
Yeah.
What I stand for is a market that is profit-based, but which accepts the need for reasonable regulations to make sure that it does the minimum to harm people, that it does the minimum to harm the environment and to cause other harms. I think that it's time for some more far-sighted thinking by capitalists about other economies, still based on the profit principle, still based on the free market principle, but which allow a wider distribution of the wealth that is created by capitalism.
But then you get into that tricky area of social engineering. You do and you do. I mean, look, isn't the best way to emancipate someone to let them find a way to own property, let them find a way to emancipate themselves materially, and then eventually to have a system around them which encourages them in their industriousness, in their entrepreneurship, and rewards them in terms of those material things which you can gain from being successful.
Yes.
And isn't the best way to be a capitalist to be useful to other people?
Yes, it is. But how do you get to that point, Gareth? You get to that point, first of all, for example, you can't take...
And by the way, I agree with you about the safety nets, and I agree with you about the minimum damage to the environment and to the people.
Yeah. But so what I'm saying is let's think these things through properly. And that's what I say in a lot of my engagements with business. You know, when I see Jabu Mabuza or Stephen Kosoff, let's rethink these things. You're talking about capitalism with a human face. That's the language that they're using now because they know that capitalism is increasingly discredited. So what do you mean?
Well, but is and it isn't. It's still the best of a bunch of bad systems. It
absolutely
certainly has done us a lot less evil than socialism has.
Well, these are big questions. I agree and I disagree. Capitalism as a global system at the moment creates enormous imaginative, creative possibility. It also creates enormous harm. Capitalism creates employment, but it can employ fewer and fewer people because of the ways technologies, etc., are developing. Capitalism of 2017 is not capitalism of 1980, is not capitalism of 1917, is not capitalism of 1850. This creature is evolving, and we have to look at it as it evolves.
Well, socialism of 2017 is socialism of 1970.
Well, that's the...
Look at Venezuela.
I know. Yeah. And look, that's
so there's no evolution there at all.
But that's my frustration, And I don't hesitate to say this, even though I come from the left, I see little evidence of new thought coming out of left thinkers, coming out of the trade unions, little grappling with the new world that we live in. So, you know, I'm more with you in this discussion than against you. But to go back to where you were a second ago, yes, encourage individual opportunity. Yes, encourage individual industriousness. But to do that, for example, you would agree, you have to have a quality basic education system
that gives
each person the opportunity to be that
person.
And
I don't think you'll be hard-pressed to find a capitalist in 2017 who will say, we don't want free basic education at a level which makes people competent
but
to take part in the
right.
economy.
But then I want more than that from that capitalist. I want not just the lip service. I want that to translate into what does this mean?
You get their tax money.
You get their tax money, but
how much more do you want?
Well, not necessarily more tax money, but more engagement with the issue of
but
what
I think
that means.
In this country, I mean, now suddenly we're seeing people like Bonang
Mohale
from Sasol, who spoke out very openly, honestly, and I thought in the most erudite fashion the other day about the role of civil society, the role of business and opposition. And how we must counter these moves by the state to become centrist and to become authoritarian. Mm. I think we're all on the same side. So you and I are really, we're having a fight that we can have after this.
Yes, no, we are on the same side.
Yeah, I don't think even those differences are insurmountable in any way compared to the differences that push the ANC elite and the rest of the country away from each other. That's a much stronger repelling.
I agree,
force,
and I think we're an example of what I call this growing middle ground. But I think this growing middle ground needs to have the discussion you and I briefly touched on, needs to have that and a whole range of other discussions so that it starts to have some sort of identity. And it doesn't need to be homogenous, but it does need to work out, well, what have we got in common? You know, I think I'm increasingly thinking we've got to change the whole way we do politics, we talk politics. Mm. You know, politics that we've inherited is based on difference. And so everybody plays up difference. When are we going to start playing up commonality and then start working the commonality?
Have you heard a good argument against Section 27, the opposition parties? Have you heard any good argument in the last 2 or 3 weeks when things have really come to a head from the other side that made you pause and go, hang on a second, maybe we got that bit wrong?
Honestly, no. Because I know what is driving the other side. And what is driving the other side is not what they claim is driving them.
Is it fear and greed?
It's fear and greed and the need to protect positions of power that they occupy. One, to protect themselves from future prosecution, two, to keep the feeding trough, the door to the feeding trough
now,
wide open.
I remember, and you'll be an expert in this because it's something that you studied too, but I've forgotten. I remember in political systems, ideology, political structures, all the rest of it, the definition that they give you for a conservative is someone who wants to keep things the same, who wants to protect what they've already got and not give an inch. In political terms, the ANC elite, the ANC leadership at the moment, I had Zweli Mkhize in here the other day and he got very upset with me, but they're forming their own new aristocracy. And he got very upset. He said, oh no, well that's inherited. But you only have to look at the surnames of current cabinet ministers in certain positions and their family and friends who get tenders and look at the small clique of people who run the ANC at the moment to know that this is at very least an oligarchy and perhaps even an aristocracy.
I think so. And it's not the type of aristocracy that it would have us believe or that would have the population believe. So,
and they're conservatives.
Very conservative. Mm. Very conservative and, as I've said, very uncaring of the lives of their electorate, of the people who vote them.
Let's go a step further than aristocracy then, and I'll dare to say feudal. Because if you look at the way that rural South Africa is arranged, It is a feudal system.
There's certainly a feudal mindset, and the way in which some of them are falling back upon the chiefs on structures, on the powers of chiefs in rural areas to shore up their own powers. Yes, there is an element of that. You know, you used the word earlier on hodgepodge. It's a hodgepodge. That's why there's not really an ideology. There's not an ideology at the center of this. This is about self-interest. So, you know, there's these big attacks on white monopoly capital, but they are so intertwined with white monopoly capital. I mean, what the hell was CPS?
They're in bed with them, yeah.
They're in bed with CPS. They're Bell Pottinger, you know, the great marketeer.
I want to hear about Bell Pottinger and what you think of this, because I've heard a lot of conspiracy theories and I'm a bit confused. Are they contracted to advise and to do PR around the Guptas and the president, or is this all made up and manufactured?
That's what they are contracted to do. You know, the ANC tried to, remember the scandal about them trying to set up their clumsy war room, and they didn't.
Their paid Twitter.
They realized that they kept on putting their foot in it, so they got the best to come and do it for them. And they're paying out, shelling out to the best, and the best are doing a reasonable job in sowing confusion about what this whole conflict is actually about at the
moment. Don't you think there's something immoral about destabilizing a country like that, being paid to do it and being paid to advise bad people to do bad things? Surely these people should be held accountable, whoever they are, wherever in the world they are.
But Gareth, that goes back to your question about, are there responsibilities on capitalism other than
Absolutely.
Making money?
That's why I bring it up. I'm giving you some ammo.
Well, thanks. I'll take the ammo, because that's precisely the point. Should you do business for evil enterprises that you know are going to destabilize and do harm? I would say no. But then the question is, where are the shareholders? I don't know the structure of Bell Pottinger, but what are the shareholders got to say about this? We should find out.
We should know these things.
But I think we would be much better in the world, not just because South Africa and the ANC and the government are not the first people who've employed these people to do this type of work. The world would be better if big companies exercised a little bit more a little bit more discretion about who they do business with and what the consequences of their business may be for society as a whole.
Mark, what do you think is a greater threat to us right now? Do you think the ANC's desire to maintain its positions of power, its network of patronage, or the business interests of the Guptas, or the president's desire to stay out of jail? Which of those is the greatest threat? Which of those is the biggest motivation?
Well, it's very hard to separate them from each other. That's the problem. I think that the president, unfortunately, is the linchpin of a lot of what is wrong in this country. So the president is protecting his people. The people are protecting the president. And he has a huge amount to lose, and his family have a huge amount to lose. That's the center of the conspiracy, and that's what we have to address, and that's what people, I think, have to understand. And you know, that's why we have to use our democracy and our constitution, peaceful and legal means, to do everything we can to have this president removed before his term of office ends.
What allies could you have that haven't yet come to the party?
Well, I think,
who are you waiting for?
I'm waiting for the faith-based organizations to speak out much more loudly and more consistently and more directly to their believers.
They have a very powerful authority and influence.
They have a very powerful authority and influence, and they can cut through some of the hypocrisy and some of the misinformation. I want to credit them that most are speaking out now. But we need a leader like Archbishop Thabo Makgoba, the Archbishop of Cape Town, to really come to the forefront in the way that somebody like Archbishop Tutu did in the past, because what we need is moral figureheads. For me, this is the heart of this, is a moral question. We need moral figureheads that people can orient their can use to sort out their confusion, and that people can trust. Because a lot of the leaders in our politics, including the leaders on our side, have been compromised. You know, the business has a leadership role, but business is not entirely without fault. It's not without fault.
Well, they're not, untainted. Their primary purpose isn't to bring about social change.
Exactly. Yeah. The trade union leaders have, you know, are not trusted.
Represent a very narrow interest.
Represent a narrow interest, but some of them, who are my friends and people I respect, are not trusted by some many people because of their role in bringing Jacob Zuma into power in the first place. So that's, you know, that's, I think that would fill a big gap at the moment.
You know, Justice Malala was in here on Thursday last week, and he jokingly said, "We need that Bonnie Tyler song, 'I Need a Hero.'" Who could lead this? Because it does need a leader. It needs someone to coordinate it. It's fine that you guys have done as much as you have up to now. But this can't be Section 27 led.
No, no, no.
It can't be Zweli Mzimavavi led. It can't be Sipho Phithiyana led. Who's going to lead it? Who is that person? It also, we can't let Julius or Musi Mamani lead it, right?
That's why I'm saying it needs a person, a man or a woman of unblemished, untarnished moral authority in this country. That's why I said to you, and I'm not saying this is the only person who could do it, but a person like Archbishop Thabo Makgoba could rally people of good, people of morality, help people to see what is right and wrong, and help people in power to find their consciences. We've got an immediate challenge. Next Tuesday, the future of our country hangs in the balance when 400 MPs decide the future of our country, when they decide on a vote of no confidence. Who is talking to the consciences of those MPs? Talking to their consciences, not threatening, not cajoling, not talking to their deepest consciences.
Well, this provides the ANC with a unique opportunity to also, for individual members in the ANC, to put the right foot forward.
Yeah.
People want the ANC to be good.
Yeah.
They want them to make the right decisions. Every step of the way, the president seems hell-bent on doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And we saw on social media over the last 24 hours, one of the ANC MPs, someone who's led two of the committees of inquiry, the commissions of inquiry into the SABC and was on the Standing Portfolio Committee that reviewed the applications for the new public protector when she was appointed. Makosi Khoza, this woman has just spoken out very loudly and clearly and in no uncertain terms about how she feels about the current leadership. Someone like that could create huge distance by making one or two comments now that would give her instant credibility.
Exactly.
We need more Makosi Khoza.
We need more people like that, and we need more people to just think deeply. You know, you talk about what we want from the ANC. Let me say this. You know, when I woke up to politics in 1977, it was through the murder of Steve Biko. When I developed my politics, it was when I went as a white kid with my parents on the blue train to Cape Town and stood on top of Table Mountain and looked across at Robben Island, by then knowing about Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu and people who were on that island. When I became involved directly in politics, it was into the ANC. When I came back to South Africa in 1989 underground, it was to join the ANC. I have always believed in this movement, not just as a leader for South Africa, but as a leader for the world. And I am no longer a member of the ANC, but I'm still a believer in everything, in its history and its traditions. And I'm still a believer that there are very, very many more good people in the ANC still than the bad people who are calling the shots. And so the good people must rise, please.
But do you think there are enough of them? Because this organization has lost its moral credibility. It's lost its political capital. It's spent it all on greed and enrichment. And positions of power and the network of patronage. What Makosi Khoza is saying is that the ANC is finished.
Well, it is finished if it doesn't sort this out and sort it out fast. I fear the ANC is finished. I fear that it's been hijacked. The capture of the ANC is a necessary prerequisite to the capture of the state. I'm not convinced that the ANC can be decaptured at the moment, but I am convinced that at this moment in time, there are more good people and honest people in the ANC than bad people, but they are allowing the bad people to do the running because people are still hedging their bets. Can we save it? Can't we save it? Is it in my interest? Isn't it in my interest? People of the ANC, if you're listening, now is the time to make that call of conscience.
How do they know who their friends and their enemies are? If we're on the side of Save South Africa or Section 27 or the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation or any of the other people who marched on Friday and who the president's been so rude about, how do we know, how can we recognize these people on the battlefield? How can we recognize our enemies on the battlefield? What questions do we need to ask them?
Well, the enemies are the people who don't have faces, who are receiving brown envelopes, who are mouthing divisive rhetoric that clearly seeks to divide rather than to heal. Our friends are the vast majority of the population of this country, the foundations, the NGOs, the CBOs, the churches, the people who speak a language of unity and non-racialism and of possibility. You know, there are a few people who maybe hard to work out which one of those they are because they're close to the edge. But I think the two categories are now fairly distinct from each other. And you have to choose which side you are on, not you personally. Everybody to make that choice.
What are the two camps called? I mean, we've got to give them names.
Well, I would say what one camp is the camp of the vision of our constitution, of social justice, of human rights, and of democratic value, a vision best encapsulated in people like Mandela and Tutu. The other is a camp that is shrouded in darkness and linked to criminality and violence, and which would subvert the Constitution if it had the power to do so. Now, how exactly you draw that, because I know you're wanting me to draw something, I'm not sure, but I think that is the choices.
We'll leave that to the cartoonists.
But that's the choices. That's really the two camps.
All right, so what lies ahead? Because you've still got lots of work to do, we all do. So what's the next step?
Well, I think two things lie ahead. The first thing is that people in South Africa must do everything they can in the next week leading up to the 18th of April, the vote of no confidence, in a peaceful and a disciplined and a lawful way to make their voices and their bodies seen. That camp of good we talked about needs to be seen, not in tens of thousands. It needs to find ways to express itself in millions, because it is millions. That has to be done in the short term, because it really is important that the ANC MPs find their consciences on the 18th of April to vote to remove this president and his cabinet. If people make themselves felt and that is successful, then we, the people of South Africa, have an even bigger job to do. And that bigger job is to turn our focus to the inequalities of this country, to our education system, to our health system, to the institutions that have broken down, and make a real commitment to fixing those inequalities. That doesn't mean everybody becomes an NGO activist in Section 27. It means, what do I do in my community? Do I join a school governing body? Do I join a clinic board? Do I, you know, there's little things that can be done, which if they were done by hundreds of thousands of people, would send a different signal into this country. And that is the big job. There's a job, Cyril Ramaphosa used the word of renewal. There's a job of renewal that we have to do, renewal of hope, because a lot of people, Gareth, a lot of poor people are losing hope. A lot of poor people are thinking, okay, you've unhitched yourself.
Yeah, they don't vote, they don't try to find work, they just feel excluded from normal society.
Exactly. And to do what I'm saying would be good is in all of our interests. It's not about charity. It's not about, oh, you poor person, I'm going to come to your rescue. It's as much about self-interest as it is about solidarity. And I think we can do that. But again, we need, you know, we need a rallying figure or figures to lead us. We need I know he's a contested character, but I would love a Barack Obama to arise and give South Africans marching orders for good and for the Constitution, to implement the Constitution.
And we have tools we've never had before. Mm-hmm. We've got means of communicating with each other like we never had before. It was so difficult. You know, you were there in 1989, underground, trying to get messages out, trying to rally the troops.
Exactly.
We managed to get it right then. Now we have no excuse.
Totally. I often say to people, there's a big feeling in the country of disempowerment, but actually we're the most powerful citizens in the world. No constitution gives its people so much power in so many places. And one of the things people have to do is know what that power is. That people need to know the constitution. We are the most empowered people in the world, really. I really mean that. It's not rhetoric.
Yeah.
It's not flourish. It's a fact.
Okay, are you energized or are you tired?
No, I'm both. I'm energized and tired.
Do you think we're close? Do you think we're close to some kind of fork in the road?
We could go
horribly wrong in the very near future. We could go really right.
Yes, we're close to exactly that fork. We are at a fork in the road. It inspires me and it instills fear in me as well. I think if we lose to this crowd led by the president, then we're in danger. People, lots of poor people are already in danger. I think we're in danger of erosion of our democracy. You know, we talk about socioeconomic rights. We take our civil and political rights for granted. You know, when I was coming here this morning, and I'll be frank with you now, you know, I saw the reports of the mayor of Ekurhuleni saying, Save South Africa, must get ready. It's going to get rough. It's going to get very rough. You know, there are threats. I'm having to, believe this or not, step up my personal security. Absolutely. I'm having to talk, do I need a bodyguard? I mean,
well,
we
know what happened to the former head of SASSA.
Exactly.
We know what happened to a number of other people who've incurred the wrath of the powers that be.
But that should not intimidate us, and that should not intimidate anybody who's listening to this show, because,
they can't kill us all.
They can't kill us all, and we're stronger. Good is stronger, without a doubt.
Who deserves the credit of being the canary in the coal mine here? Because Julius Malema left the ANC and started the EFF, 2.5, 3 years ago. Zwelinzima Mavavi decided to exit COSATU. Well, I mean, he was kind of pushed out, but he started mouthing off about what a danger the president might become long before he became an obvious threat. There are people who've been writing editorials. Who do you think deserves to... Because at the time of Thabo Mbeki's ousting in Polokwane, I thought, well, this is a good sign. There's a centrist being moved out. Mm. There's a guy who had a very iron grip on what was and wasn't tolerated inside the ANC. When he was gone, I thought, okay, well, this will democratize the institution more. Little did we know.
Yeah,
I mean, this is brilliant work on the president's part. Machiavellian.
Yeah. Look, I think a lot of people, there's a lot of individuals that you could pull out who've helped change, who've been the canaries in the coal mine.
Who do you listen to? I mean, who do you think is sensible on these things? Who do you go to when you want to see what kind of a picture the political landscape is painted in?
I'm not sure if I go to, that's a very good question. I'm not sure if I go, I go back to the poetry that I read, which is about people, and to the history books that I read that give you a sense of how individuals have made a difference.
Now, the reason I ask you is because it's difficult to know who to trust. We're in the era of fake news.
Yeah.
Nobody really knows what is fact and what is opinion anymore because the lines are blurred. So who do you trust?
Well, I don't give unqualified trust to anybody any longer. I think that's one of the things we all have to learn.
Right.
I will not just give trust. I think that Zwelinzima Mavavi has played a very important role. I think Mampele Rampele, even though her project crashed, was important in breaking out of the mold of the politics. I think people like Barbara Hogan, quiet as she is, not at the forefront of the national stage is somebody I would go to seek advice and know that I would always get good advice. I think Sipo Pichana is somebody who has stepped out and stepped up again to meet the challenges of the new time. It's people like that that I would seek advice of. I think Julius has played an incredibly important role.
Monsieur Lakota.
You know, they've all done different things. And it goes back, Gareth, to the point I made a minute ago. I think the best thing for our country, if we can get through this next few weeks, would be for those people and others to sit down and say, let's work the commonality between us now for a period. I don't think that's too much to ask.
No.
Let's work that commonality. Let's do things differently. Let's fix the basic education system. Let's do this and this and this. Because we all have an interest in it. You know, I saw an interesting thing. You know, NUMSA has come out with a crazy and I think absolutely wrong position. We're not support. Let the capitalists fight. Let the Gupta capitalism fight white monopoly capitalism. This has got nothing to do with the workers. This is just rubbish. And I saw Julius tweeted a reply that said, this is not about political parties. This is about our country. That's why we're coming together. And we have to come together for our country and not come together for our country as some sort of geographic abstract concept, but come together for our country on the basis of the 50 million people who live in it and on the basis that, you know, my little 13-year-old boy who I love dearly and who inspires me is just like a little 13-year-old boy who lives in Deep Slut, but lives in a situation that threatens him on a daily basis, who's loved by his mum and dad in the same way I love my child.
Absolutely.
That should be the basis.
Keep doing the good work, and let's add to the strategic alliance. I think, you know, you can't sit on the sidelines anymore. I've heard people who are objective journalists saying this is no longer about trying to give this false equivalence between, well, that's this side of the argument and it's as valid as this side of the argument. There's no such thing. No. I think we can see now that you have to nail your colors to the mast. Mm. And any South African who is prepared to wallow in that space in between will find themselves eaten up.
Absolutely.
By either side. They'll Absolutely. Either be subsumed into the good or subsumed into the bad.
That's precisely where I wrote a little note to some of my friends this morning who are sort of not so much standing on the sidelines, but making a point of being proper and critical. And, you know, this is nobody knows quite how to put the next foot forward, but where to put it. But
for a moment, suspend disbelief and choose your side and put your back to it.
Exactly,
we need it.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, keep doing your good work. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for the time this morning.
Mark Haywood, anytime. We'll have you again soon. Hopefully, we'll be talking about much happier things.
I hope so, too.
You and I can have an argument about Marxist dialectic. We don't have to have these conversations about actual existential crises. CliffCentral.com